from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. From the early days of his campaign to just last week, President Trump has made attacking the media a staple of his tweets and public pronouncements.
Just remember, what you're seeing and what you're reading is not what's happening.
Trump calls the journalists who cover him purveyors of fake news, even the enemy of the people. There's always been an adversarial relationship between presidents and the journalists who cover them, but not like this. We're in new territory, and it's become part of the divide across America. Many Trump supporters believe the media are biased against him. Are they right? Reporters say the president's attacks on them set a dangerous tone, both here and abroad. Do they have a point? This hour, On Point, the president versus the press. You can join us on air or online. Is the media biased against President Trump? Is his attack on the media out of bounds and dangerous? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining us first from Cleveland is David Falkenflik. He's media correspondent for NPR. David will also be taking over hosting this program on Fridays, starting later next month. And David, congratulations for that, first of all, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, brother. I'm excited.
Yeah,
really excited.
We're all excited to have you part of this great family, On Point family. So I want to start with this recent meeting between President Trump and Arthur Sulzberger, the publisher of the New York Times. It was supposed to remain off the record, but Trump tweeted about it, saying that the two talked about the massive amounts of fake news out there. Then Sulzberger put out a statement saying that he talked to the president about the dangers of referring to members of the media as enemies of the people, and he's particularly concerned about the dangers overseas. What's he referring to there, in your view?
Right. So the young Arthur Sulzberger, who took over from his father's publisher of the Times at the beginning of this year, took the meeting at the request. He was invited by Sarah Sanders, and it was just the four of them in there. So the president of the United States, Donald Trump, Sarah Sanders, press secretary, Sulzberger, and his editorial page editor, James Bennett. And Dean Baquet, the editor of the paper, didn't go because he doesn't go to off-the-record meetings. Mm. And I think that's particularly wise with Trump, who tends to often disclose what is said in what are assumed to be private conversations in extremely public ways. In this instance, I also spoke to people Sunday at the time, so I know what Sulzberger has told people privately that occurred at the meeting. And Sulzberger said that he wanted to go in there to accept – he'll take a meeting anywhere with any figure of interest in news and interest in his paper. And he's willing to hear complaints about the paper without making promises or cutting deals. But he wanted to hear what the president had to say. He said he brought up about 20 minutes into the conversation the question of fake news and of the harm of enemy of the people, and then he brought it up again about 50 minutes into the hour. And I think that was Sarah Sanders apparently tried to sort of stop the conversation after about a half hour, and they kept going. And Trump, I think, enjoyed the conversation. One of the fascinating things was that Trump apparently lit up and he was excited. And what Sulzberger told others afterward was that he thinks that Trump wanted him to make an ask, that is, stop going so hard on us. Stop saying we're fake news. Stop beating up on the New York Times. So Sulzberger decided to be explicit and say, I'm not asking you for anything here. Mm-hmm. I'm not making an ask. I'm not asking for a favor. You can attack the New York Times itself and you can attack me by name. But what you're doing is undermining people's ability to take in information about the world around them. And that's not only a problem here, but by calling us the enemy of the state, you're giving cover to dictators abroad, people like Assad in Syria, the leaders of Egypt, of Putin certainly, but of Duterte in the Philippines and other places where people are acting with impunity against journalists. And one of the things that Sulzberger says he said was these aren't people going after critics who are making things up about them. These are dictators essentially trying to squelch anybody's ability to perform a democratic role of providing a check of outside information for the public against them.
Right.
He said that's a problem. That's something that America stands up for. Yeah. And what Sulzberger claims is that Trump said afterward, he tapped his temple and said, you've given me a lot to think about here.
Interesting. David, do you think there's evidence overseas that these dictators, these strong leaders have been emboldened by these inflammatory remarks about the press by the president?
Yeah, you're seeing the phrase fake news pop up. You're seeing people cite this, in continents all over the world and use that, particularly people trying to discredit reporting that they find critical and inconvenient, as opposed to take off after things that are actually fabricated. Let's not forget, when we first started talking about fake news, it was the kind of thing where, you'd see on Facebook a post from this news organization called the Denver Guardian. And on Facebook, everything looked the same. So it looked just like something that would look like from the Guardian of the UK or from the Denver Post. But actually, it was a made-up site, and it was made-up news on a financial desire to just get people to click on it. Well, that was what we used to call fake news, and Trump kind of brilliantly, but in some ways malevolently, at least as it comes to the news business, called it fake news. And so he called fake news things that he didn't want people to give credence to. And that's been a problem. And it's helped drive, exacerbate, levels of mistrust that already existed, some for good reason, some for not, with the news media already.
I want to talk about those levels of distrust and what has exacerbated them. But I want to first just stick with this theme of the potential danger of attacking the media like this. So this meeting with Sulzberger took place just 3 weeks after the shooting rampage at the Capital Gazette newsroom in Annapolis, Maryland. That left five people dead. There's no evidence at all that the attack was prompted by the president's inflammatory comments about the press. But do you worry that this kind of rhetoric could indeed encourage someone to take matters into their own hands in this way someday?
I think it is very dangerous for the president of the United States to call any group in society that is not somehow posing a mortal threat to the republic or its people, to call them enemy of the people. That is a phrase that dehumanizes, it turns them into rhetorical targets in ways that I think are problematic, even if there is no violence, and obviously could be much worse. We live in a time where homicide rates are by and large pretty low, but there have been spates of mass killings. What happened at the Annapolis Capitol is among them. I'm not going to associate that with the president's rhetoric, but I'd say it. It fosters rather than criticism. It fosters a kind of hatred.
Yep.
And I don't think that that's the kind of rhetoric you want for something that performs a role in society, however flawed you might think it is, however human it might prove to be, however problematic individual stories are. There are a lot of people that are trying to perform a real role in getting information out to the public so that, people and consumers can also be informed citizens. And I don't think that that is, I don't think it is a partisan stance or an ideological position to say that that is an unhealthy thing for a public official to do.
Listeners, we're talking about President Trump's war with the media. What do you make of it? And what do you make, by the way, of the media's role here? Is there evidence that the media has been biased against them? We want to hear about that. We're going to discuss that as well. Let's hear a little bit of the president's voice. Here he is, President Trump, who often labels the American news media as enemies of his administration. Here he is at the Celebrate Freedom concert earlier this month.
The fake media is trying to silence us. But we will not let them, because the people know the truth. The fake media tried to stop us from going to the White House, but I'm president and they're not.
President Trump speaking at the Celebrate Freedom concert earlier this month. And David, here's a tweet just today from the president, just 30 minutes before we went to air. The fake news is going crazy. They are totally unhinged. And in many ways, after witnessing firsthand the damage they do to so many innocent and decent people, I enjoy watching. In 7 years, when I'm no longer in office, their ratings will dry up and they will be gone. So bottom line, David, how has the coverage of this White House changed under President Trump in light of these kinds of attacks?
Well, the first thing that I think it's important to do is to recognize that, although it sounds like at that event that was a freedom celebration of freedom, it sounds like one of the freedoms he wants to celebrate is freedom from the press and freedom from expression of critiques rather than of it, affirming of it. But this presidency, actually what he wants, this president, what he wants most is a lot of media coverage. This really is a truly media presidency.
Yeah.
And he wants a ton of coverage, and he wants it to be adulatory. He wants it to be presenting him as a strong leader, even when it's critical of him. And he is, you know, really unnerved and angry when it presents him in other lights, when it questions the integrity of the elections that got him into office, when it questions his soundness as a leader, when it questions the wisdom or of what he's done or the effectiveness of how he does things. Anything that undermines the image that he presents or wants to present on TV and elsewhere, that upsets him most. He would love to be in the front page of the New York Times every day in positive ways. He would love the New York Times. He tweeted – not only did he tweet what you tweeted, but the New York Times, which he goes after as much or more as anyone, he retweeted a beautiful photograph from the New York Times that presented him in the White House in good light this morning, you know, minutes after the other tweet that you mentioned, minutes before it. You know, it's not like he's not consuming the New York Times. It's not like he doesn't give them credence when it's in his favor. So, you know, there is this disassociated relationship between what he says about the news media and what he actually wants from it, which is he wants it all the time to be in his camp. The news media's coverage of him has been extraordinary and exceptional. But this is not a normal presidency. This is a very idiosyncratic from a person who, you know, you think of the movie The Truman Show. As a public figure, it is though he was incubated in public view in the press, first in the New York tabloids, then, you know, in some ways as a reality TV star, and then as a figure who was turned to as a kind of pundit, particularly by Fox News starting in 2011, but also by NBC, which was the home of his reality show. And so he became a figure who started to be, you know, he flirted, I guess, in 2000 before all that happened with running for office on the reform ticket. But he really came into public view as a figure in and of the media. And so our coverage has been extraordinary because that's the age we live in.
Yeah, and you touch on an irony that I want to get into after the break, that we have a president who makes attacking the media a staple of his message, but as you suggest, he's also a master of manipulating the media and using it to his own advantage. And I want to talk a little bit more about that after the break. Listeners, we are talking about the relationship between the White House, its press corps, which has become more fraught than ever before. You can join the conversation. Are the president's attacks on the press dangerous? Should he tone down his rhetoric? Or is the media biased against this president? Or both? I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about President Trump's war on the press. He's called journalists the enemy of the people. You can join the conversation. Is the president putting reporters at risk with this? Are the media biased against him? We're speaking with David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR. I want to play a little bit of sound from last week. Last Wednesday, CNN reporter Caitlin Collins was banned from a White House press event by the president's communications team after asking President Trump a question about Michael Cohen as the president posed for photos with European Union President Jean-Claude Juncker. Here's Collins speaking to CNN about what happened.
They thought the questions that I posed to President Trump were inappropriate and inappropriate for that venue. I told them that is often our only chance to ask the president questions. Those questions were questions any reporter would have asked, and I was there to represent all of the networks and therefore ask about the questions of the day along with the other reporters and my colleagues in that room.
And here's some pushback from Vice President Pence, who defended the administration's actions against the CNN reporter in an interview with Fox News that aired this past Sunday.
This administration believes in the freedom of the press, and President Trump and our entire administration have provided extraordinary access to the media. But maintaining the decorum that is due at the White House, I think, is an issue that we'll continue to work forward. But I'm very confident that whether it be with that network or any members of the media, that we'll continue to work in a way that ensures the access of the American people.
We're talking with David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR. And let me introduce Olivier Knox. He's president of the White House Correspondents Association, chief Washington correspondent for Sirius XM radio. Olivier, it's good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks for having me on.
Love to get you to chime in on this conversation, particularly about the CNN reporter who was banned from a White House event. What do you make of that? What does that tell you about how fraught this relationship has become?
Well, it's been fraught since the beginning. You'll remember that during the campaign, candidate Trump banned individual outlets from some of his rallies. So we have a body of work here. We know coming in that that he can be very hostile to individual reporters and individual outlets. I want to go back a little bit, though, and say we can't lose track of the fact that what the president is doing is a political act. Mm-hmm. He has effectively weaponized mistrust in media that predates him. And so he has fed off of it, and he has fed that sentiment as well. The relationship is relatively fraught. They have always hated the tradition of shouted questions in the Oval Office, which also well predates Donald Trump. I've been covering the White House off and on since December of 2000. I can tell you, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, all were shouted at. One of the early moments in this administration, I was pulled aside by a senior official who basically denounced the practice and said, "I bet you never shouted at Barack Obama." And I met this both with disbelief and by pulling out my phone and showing him a few videos of reporters doing exactly that.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I'm intrigued by this term you use, weaponizing the sort of the distrust of the media that's always been there. David, let me ask you about that. What explains that deep distrust of the media that has always been there, that President Trump can so brilliantly exploit?
You know, look, distrust of the media is in some ways bipartisan or nonpartisan. Yeah. People often like to complain about their local papers, like to complain about national papers, like to complain about news organizations that deliver news, particularly about politicians or policies they like, and news that it's unwelcome. And so that stretched back a long time. There's also this asymmetrical antagonism that's a strain going back in the Republican Party more than a half century. And you can trace it particularly picking up with the Nixon administration, Vice President Spiro Agnew, and continuing on. You know, George H.W. Bush, who had a famously pretty good relationship with the press, used to jog with reporters down in the Washington Mall in his reelection campaign, had bumper stickers that said, "Annoy the media, reelect Bush." You know, there were chants on the floor, I think it was in St. Paul in 2008, the RNC, Olivia may remember that, you know, basically denouncing NBC for a report. You know, this has been an asymmetrical anger at the press from the right. There has been a strain as well, particularly in the far left during and the left during Vietnam civil rights movement at times, frustration that national media wasn't picking up more on their concerns about the fact and the way in which the war was being waged and over time other issues. And I think that there was on the left a dissatisfaction mounted over things like the coverage of Clinton impeachment, the recount questions in 2000, and then the failures of the press about weapons of mass destruction claims about the Iraqis and the buildup to the war in Iraq. So there started to be this resentment on the left. What Trump has done is exactly as Olivier said. He has weaponized what existed and turned it into a cudgel with which to beat the press, even as he's desperate for its affirmation. And he uses it to deflect attention from his own policies, from the substance of what he's doing, from the often ineffectiveness of what he's doing, the disorder at the White House itself, and in fact all the myriad legal troubles that people in his wider circles are facing. Using this is basically, as he has said at times to people, as a way of discrediting the press preemptively, even in anticipation of worse headlines and coverage to come.
Yeah. Olivier, and David, stand by. I want to actually go to some callers. We've got a lot of them standing by. Let's start off with Kathleen, who's calling from Dayton, Ohio. Kathleen, you're on the air. Good to have you. Thanks for the call.
Yeah. Hi, Anthony. You know, as both your guests have pointed out, you know, that Trump actually has some ground to stand on based on the lack of confidence that we have in our media outlets. I mean, I pride myself in listening to and reading from the right, left, and center. And as your guest pointed out, you know, we watched in the New York Times and so many other media outlets being an echo chamber for the Bush administration with the Iraq WMDs. We had to nothing wrong with listening to Democracy Now! And McClatchy News with Lande and Strobel, you know, but the New York Times was, you know, interesting that the owner now is confronting Trump on these issues. However, they went along with that. And then in the more recently, we had the 2016, you know, run up to that campaign where Maddow and Reid and Lawrence O'Donnell gave Trump endless time, endless coverage because of the ratings. It's a business. And then didn't cover Sanders very often, wouldn't touch Hillary Clinton's war record or her ties to Wall Street. They were basically pounding the pavement for Hillary. So, you know, if, as David said, if we want an informed citizenry, we have to have the media really trying to inform us with accurate and verifiable information. And that's not what they always do by any means.
Interesting. Kathleen, I really appreciate your call. Olivia, I'd love to get you to respond. And let me just read another tweet from President Trump. This was from July 29th. I'm just going to read part of the tweet. 90% of media coverage of my administration is negative, despite the tremendously positive results we are achieving. It's no surprise that confidence in the media is at an all-time low. That's from President Trump. And there have been studies that have suggested that a lot of the coverage of President Trump, maybe for good reason, but a majority of the coverage is negative. I'd love to get you to respond to that and chime in and response to Kathleen's call.
Sure. So I think what's heartening about Kathleen's call is that was media criticism, right? And
yeah,
that is fundamentally different from calling us from recycling Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin's line about enemies of the people. Those are completely different things. I've been physically assaulted by a Gore supporter in 2000, Kerry and Bush supporters in 2004 separately, you can imagine. And I still divide the two eras in media attacks in pre and post February of 2017, which is when the president first lobbed the enemies of the people line. So I completely welcome criticism of media coverage. I believe me, my list is long. I have a lot of grievances with the way we do our jobs, but the problem is criticizing the content and inviting hate are two different things. I have a number of colleagues who get frequent and unfortunately credible death threats these days. Mm. Some of my colleagues have personal security details. These are different things. If you want to take apart a piece that I wrote, say that I got it wrong, because I do sometimes, that I got it wrong, or that you think I had my thumb on the scale for something, that is a fundamentally different act than declaring me an enemy of the people.
Yeah, got it. Good point. Let's go to David, who's calling from Boston. David, you're on the air. Thanks for the call.
Hi, Anthony. Thank you. I just wanted to – I'm a former journalist, and while I didn't cover the campaign in 2016, I was certainly you know, out on the streets as a community journalist. And you know, the after 20 years of photojournalism, the you know, sort of palpable anger really ramped up around that time. And you know, it would be, we're talking at random events, sporting events, and things that really had nothing to do with politics. So it does trickle down. I also wanted to say that I find it a little ironic. I mean, the founders, They specifically said we need a free press during a time when the press was amazingly partisan. And so, that's just one other point to make.
David, thanks so much for that call. David Folkenflik, to you, one of the sort of hallmarks of this moment in our time is sort of the siloing of a lot of the mainstream media. I'm not so much talking about NPR, I don't think. I'm not talking about the New York Times as much as the sort of split between broadcast outlets like Fox News and MSNBC, where you've just got this siloing of organizations that are speaking to essentially their backers in a very specific way. Do you see this time as somehow contributing more to that siloing of the way folks are getting their news and information?
Sure. I mean, if you think about it in terms of TV, it's like a cable model instead of a broadcast model.
Right.
People are able to seek out and find news that is not only framed and wrapped in ways they like, but even chooses the subjects that they want to hear about and not the ones that they don't. So they can go to MSNBC and get a full-on, you know, several-hour block that is going to trash the president from both parties, but nonetheless tend to be people who are going to be very critical of the president. Or they can go on Fox and find apologists and supporters of the president up and down the lineup. And you can find that in different ways online as well. One of the great things about the immediacy of the digital moment and of apps on our phones is that we can get information instantaneously from all over the world. But that means that, you know, we don't have to turn – I'm in Cleveland at the moment. We don't have to turn the Plain Dealer or Cleveland.com in order to do that, which might have given us a broader gauged look and a more measured way of presenting what's unfolding in front of us. It's not to say that opinion journalism can't be very good, but the question is, you know, the market proposition is not such that the verification has to be as tight or that there has to be transparency on what you're basing the conclusions that you reach. You know, good opinion journalism, good point of view journalism is out there, but it has to account for facts that cut against the overall thrust of the argument being made and to, you know, take points in the other direction. And if they're not willing to do those things and willing to be very transparent about how they're reaching the assessments they're making, as I think is, you know, hard to find on a place like Fox when it's, you know, going after the president's investigators or the president's critics, then it's hard to give as much credence to that kind of outfit.
Let's go to Mike, who's calling from Indianapolis, Indiana. Mike, you're on the air. Thanks for the call. Please go ahead.
Hi, Anthony. I wanted to make a comment about this whole idea of the siloing of the media. I actually, right now I'm listening to NPR, but I take in conservative media. I also take in independent media. And when Trump criticizes the media, he's not criticizing Breitbart or Sean Hannity, right? He's criticizing the mainstream left media. And I want to give you an example of how they construct different worlds. I remember, you might remember right after the the election, all the mainstream media outlets were saying, how do we get it wrong? You know, the polls were wrong. How did that happen? And then we had all this analysis of the polls. Well, if you had been reading Breitbart and Zero Hedge, you would have seen a story saying, you know, the latest, you know, ABC poll or CNN poll has oversampled Democrats by 15%. And they'd provide a link to the CNN site, and you could see CNN's layout of the demographic composition. And you'd see, sure enough, there were 15% more Democrats. And the Trump organization knew this. So you'd also read in Breitbart back then that because they knew this, they were running independent, their own polling internally. Hmm. And that's why the Trump campaign and conservatives felt that he was going to win because the internal polls were showing him neck to neck or ahead, you know? So then after the election, Breitbart runs a headline saying, if you're reading Breitbart, you weren't surprised that Trump won. Yet, you know, the Democrat CNN is saying, how do we get the polls wrong? Well, you were oversampling. And one more point, you know, in the WikiLeaks emails, John Podesta actually had an email that he sent out to the media, and it was a PDF guide to oversampling that you could download and read. It was, I think, 37 pages, and it showed state by state for every demographic how to sample so that you could oversample Democrats.
Interesting.
So they're two different universes.
No, Mike, I take your point. And yeah, go ahead. Is that Olivia who wants to chime in?
Yeah, I want to jump into that. To Mike's point, on the Friday before Election Day, the Trump folks gathered a bunch of reporters and briefed them on what was coming, and they gave themselves no better than a 20% chance of winning. So the idea that they were confident going into this and that they were certainly going to win is just not borne out.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think that, to Olivia's point, I think Steve Bannon was convinced they were going to lose, and Steve Bannon had been the chairman of Breitbart itself. I think that the oversampling question, there are people who are smarter about this than I are, but the assumption clearly mistaken was that there was an oversampling of Democrats because there was a surge of people self-identifying as Democrats as a result of people peeling away from voting for the Republican ticket because the perception was that they were less likely to vote for Trump.
Yeah.
So I think that there are times that pollsters will say these are not wholly fixed populations. And so when people talk about oversampling, although there is a problem of oversampling, there can also be a question of, well, the populations and self-definitions are fluid. But there were mistakes, obviously, in the ways in which those things were constructed. Were they biases? I'm hard-pressed to think that a pollster wants somehow to be shown to wrong in what he or she does for a poll that will appear in CNN or the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal. I think that these people try to get it right and mess up sometimes.
Yeah. Let me bring it back to the way President Trump might be affecting the way the media operates. I want to read a tweet here and get you, Olivia, to respond to this. KLT tweets, real Donald Trump definitely plays the media and does it brilliantly. Media continues to chase his tail, just as in 2015 and 2016. Do you feel that there's validity in that, Olivia? Do you think that do you feel played sometimes down there in Washington by the president, I guess is the question.
You know, sometimes I do worry that instead of containing the outbreak, we're driving the infected monkey to the airport. But I think that some of the criticism that I think we need to keep in mind, I think, are things like putting a camera on an empty podium in anticipation of Donald Trump and taking him live uncommented. That's not coverage exactly.
Right.
I'm not sold on the idea that this is six-dimensional chess. I think a lot of it's very reactive.
All right. We're talking about President Trump's war on the press. You can join the conversation. Do you think the press is too negative about President Trump? What are the dangers when a president refers to journalists as enemies of the people? We'll be back after a short break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
I'm Ann Powers from NPR Music. Last summer, we launched Turning the Tables, a project that radically changed how we talk about the history of popular music, with a list of the 150 greatest albums by women. This week, we're launching Season 2, looking at the 200 greatest songs by 21st century women. Check out who made the list and who didn't at n.pr/turningthetables.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the way the White House press corps is covering the Trump administration. You can join the conversation. Are you concerned that the media are biased against this president? How should we cover a president who makes so many statements that are inconsistent with the facts? We're talking with David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR, Olivier Knox, president of the White House Correspondents Association. And let me introduce Mona Charon. She's a syndicated columnist in Washington, also author of the recent book, Sex Matters, How Modern Feminism Lost Touch with Science, Love, and Common Sense. Mona, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
I know you've been listening along. Let me ask you straight out, how has press coverage of the White House changed under President Trump?
Look, I think your previous guests have commented on the longstanding suspicion of the press, particularly on the right. I mean, you can say that both sides have their complaints with the press, and of course they always will, but this relationship that Trump has is part of a long pattern where much of the mainstream media did tilt to the left, and their refusal ever to acknowledge their own bias is a source of continuing agony to conservative audiences. I can tell you this, having been a conservative speaker for many years, that the one topic that's a perennial is press bias. So the ground was already prepared, and Trump was able to weaponize it and to take advantage of it in a way that no one else had, and because he's completely unscrupulous. I would just note that that Trump's complaint with the press is not that it is dishonest. Oh, he'll say it's dishonest, but what he really means is that it's negative. He doesn't mind dishonesty when it's on his own side. What he minds is whether it's positive or negative. So that's his big critique, is that they are critical of him.
Right. But this idea that there's been this long-term tilt of the press to the left, as you suggested, does that suggest in your view that in some way the press needs to adjust a little bit in the way they respond to President Trump? Or what's the prescription here in your view?
Look, I have some sympathy with members of the media who roll their eyes and constantly emphasize how much this president lies. I mean, it is just prodigious, and it's very, very difficult to deal with. But I do think that it only inflames Trump's fans, or even people who are open-minded about him, when they see the constant drumbeat of contempt that you find in places like MSNBC and CNN and so forth about Trump. I think the better route is to just play it straight, tell the truth. If it's fine to report that the president's statement today is inconsistent with his statement last week, but to hold back a bit on the open antagonism, which I think is not healthy.
Mm. I want to read a comment from our website, Marcus Six, along these lines, Mona. Marcus Six writes, "I wouldn't go as far as to call the media the enemy of the people. I think they've decided what is right for everyone, and it's their job to convince people to do the right thing. They've decided it's more important to convince people than to be unbiased." David Folkenflik, though, I'd love you to respond to Mona Charon's idea, this idea of this sort of long-term tilt to the left of the press and this constant drumbeat of contempt that you hear in some areas against President Trump?
You know, I think there are ways in which you can look at particularly major national organizations, and a lot of decisions were being made that set the news agenda for decades out of corner offices in Midtown Manhattan. And even if they weren't explicitly liberal, there was sort of a uniformity of place and space of mind. People sort of tended to think the same way about certain things. But, you know, pendulum swing. For many years, gays were covered as kind of a curiosity and with contempt or at best patronizingly, but often with a sense of this is somebody from a foreign country that we don't understand and don't want to visit. And it took a lot of decades for the mainstream so-called liberal media or even outright liberals to understand and treat them in sort of a full citizen way in the way in which they lived their lives. The environmental movement became something that I think was ultimately kind of accepted by the mainstream media, and there are conservatives who have skepticism about certain kinds of regulatory approaches to dealing with environmental issues who felt, hey, the mainstream media is just swallowing things whole. I think certain things became seen in the way that the civil rights movement was covered. And that was something that ultimately was taken up by news organizations, I think, courageously at times on the local level in the South and in other parts of the country. And then as news organizations realized they had been slow to the issue and had themselves in some ways racist past, they – you know, by informing the public of what was clearly outrageous behavior, they became seen and identified with that movement. And in a sense, rightly so. But then there were people who resented the way in which that was presented and portrayed, in which their communities were presented and portrayed by the press locally and nationally. And so that became part of the template of resentment. So these pushes and pulls, you know, the media, it's hard to say the media has been this outrageous left-wing radical outfit when at times it was enforcing norms that people were resisting against from the left. But yeah, I think there are times at which, you know, even Jill Abramson, the former editor of the New York Times, you know, said to me once, look, we think of ourselves not as liberal but as cosmopolitan. Well, that may have a certain outlook and it may seem a certain sophistication, suggest a certain interest in you know, open inquiry and sophistication of outlook. And speak to people in little, I don't know, New York states of mind all over the nation, and all over the world. But you can imagine that seeming off-putting if that's the voice and the approach to other people who say, well, that doesn't speak to me and for me. I think one of the nice things about public radio is people tend to be heard in their own voices and reflect in a way that when we do what we do right, that they recognize and that they appreciate.
Yeah. Let's go ahead, Olivia, please.
So I want to combine the comment from the website, our earlier point about siloing, and David's just made point here, and say the most common criticism that I get, and I realize this is anecdote, not data, the most common criticism that I get about the media has nothing to do with an ideological point. It has to do with the fact that we're not talking about the things that matter to them day to day. So if you look at polls, which are more scientific than my anecdotal information, they care about healthcare. They care about wages. They care about the opioid crisis. There are state-to-state variations in what people really want. And the most common criticism I get is, ugh, why are you talking to me about this? You know, why are you talking to me about North Korea? Why are you talking to me about these other things? I'm really worried. I'm underwater in my house. I don't know what the industry that I depend on for my livelihood is doing. You're not talking to me. You're talking about these other cosmopolitan things, and I don't really know how to fix that. But it's definitely an issue that I get a lot.
It's really interesting that you brought that up. You know, Olivia, just yesterday I was talking to Abby Livingston, a reporter with the Texas Tribune, about this week's news, and she said something that really sort of stuck with me, which is along the lines of what you said. We were talking about the coming midterm elections, and she said something like, "What voters really care about is health care." And she said specifically health care, but we're all talking about Michael Cohen and Donald Trump. I thought that was a great point. And I bring this point up and fully acknowledge that we're spending an hour talking about Donald Trump right now. So maybe we're feeding into this in a big way, for which I take responsibility. But Mona Charon, I'd love to talk to you about, I mean, get you to respond to that idea. I mean, does the press sort of miss the big subjects that folks really want to talk about? And does that feed into this cynicism about the press, I guess?
Well, I think the people, you know, this has been the triumph of a market failure in a sense, because people have been able to curate their own news now and decide exactly what kind of news they want to consume. And so rather than complaining to the media that you're not covering what I'm interested in, they find the news outlets that are catering to exactly what they're interested in. And thereby, they close off their minds and souls to any other point of view, and they become ever more radicalized. And this is happening on both sides of the spectrum. I think that is the greatest challenge at this moment in our history, is that the people are self-segregating, and they are living in basically different information universes. The coverage on Fox and the coverage on CNN and other networks don't even overlap in terms of the topics that are covered. And so it's not even just a different point of view, it's a different universe. And I think this is incredibly divisive, and I think it's up to all of us, including, you know, on the right and the left, and people who are interested in our civic health, to figure out how to bridge those gaps. I belong to several organizations now that are sort of left-right conversations in an attempt to bridge these divides, because if we live in different information universes, it's very, very dangerous.
Let's take a couple more calls. Gar is calling from Freeport, Maine. Gar, you're on the air. Good to have you. Go ahead.
Hi, Anthony. Thank you. I think that we are perhaps missing one point, that the third estate, or the press, is being talked about in terms of journalists and their stance. I would love to see the press, and that means both print and media, try to educate the importance of a free press, regardless of whose side, liberal or conservative press, that free press is the tool of democracy, and that if free press is undermined, democracy is undermined. And I think that the communicators of our country need to offset the president's bully pulpit to explain how critical support of press of all opinions is, that the founding fathers established free press as the centerpiece of a democracy. Without a free press, you do not have a democracy. Hmm. And not wallow in issues so much as to bolster the notion that informed citizenry seeking information from multiple sources and the freedom to ask questions is the key point.
Gar, I really appreciate
Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, go ahead, Mona Charon. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
Thomas Jefferson famously said once that if he had to choose between a government without a press or a press without a government, he would choose the press without a government. And, you know, this president is the first that I can think of who has not reaffirmed his belief in the importance of a free press, who has not at some time acknowledged that while he doesn't like the coverage, and who does like negative coverage, but that this is part of our free society and that it's essential and so forth. Every other president that I can think of has reaffirmed their commitment to that, but not this one.
Olivier, to that point, we talked earlier about the case of CNN's Caitlin Collins being barred from a press event at the White House. Are you concerned? I mean, are there other cases like that that suggest that the Trump White House is actually trying to suppress a free press?
Well, you know, I was thinking back when this whole thing happened with Caitlin, which I condemned in my role as the White House Correspondents Association president. I was thinking back to past conflicts with the news media. I'm so old that I remember it was eyebrow raising when President George W. Bush walked from the White House to the Marine One helicopter with a copy of Bernie Goldberg's Bias book visible. That feels like a quaint era. You know, I'll say this about the situation last week. It was both heartening and slightly worrisome that we had this unanimity of response from across every news platform, every news outlet that spoke up. Came out and said, this is not the right thing to do. This kind of retaliation is not the right thing to do. And I say slightly worrisome because what it told me, one, it was very heartening because it means we can look forward to their support going forward. But it was slightly worrisome because it suggested that everyone realizes that tomorrow it could be them, or in the next administration it could be them.
Let's take one more call at least. Delcy is calling from Milford, Connecticut. Delcy, good to have you on the air. Thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Hello, Anthony. Thank you for taking my call. There's a difference between media and news, and we seem to conflate the two. We have large corporations that control the media. We have some independents, like the New York Times, who are giving us some information. But the American public needs information, not a reporter's opinions. We'll make up our own minds. And what's happening in this country, I'm glad we're discussing it, but is a complete outrage. And I don't understand how the press has been swallowed up by this.
And when you say swallowed up by this, what are you referring to? What's the this? Is it the cover? Are you talking about the way it covers the Trump administration?
The way it covers the news. We had a report several months ago that a bill went through Congress last year removing the DEA's powers from going after the pharmaceutical houses. That wasn't in the news. How could that not be in the news?
Well, this is a good... Delcy, I appreciate you putting this point on the table. And David, we sort of touched on this idea, but it seems like one of the points that Delcy's getting to is the way the sort of Trump outrage machine, if you will, has swallowed up a lot of the oxygen to focus on other issues. Is that a fair concern to bring to light?
It's absolutely a fair concern. I do think that the media needs to, and the major organizations, NPR, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and others are trying to chew gum and walk at the same time to cover the substantive issues and the policies and the implications and the factors figuring into those policies behind the scenes, even as they're following. You know, what Trump does is news. His rhetoric is news. You know, communication is a very important part of the presidential role in modern society, particularly the way that which information flows. And I do think it remains news, as John Dickerson of CBS said. You know, it should be news when the president says things that aren't true and when the president says things that are deceptive. And the press has to find a way to be, you know, civil but not docile. The press has to find a way to be relevant and not reverent, and I think it needs to not be apologetic about its role, to make clear why it's doing what it's doing, and yet be clear-eyed on things and not respond to everything in the same key and at the same pitch. And I think that's the frustration that you hear both from people on the right and from consumers of news who are basically being deluged from. I mean, we're in a time of slightly manufactured crisis. The economy is doing fine. We are at war some, but not to the degree that we were. This doesn't have to be a time of such conflict. This administration has chosen to engage the public and the press in that way and at that level, and the press has to find a way to make it absorbable by the public.
Well, David, I think you express really well the challenge that is in front of all of us. David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR, soon to be one of the hosts of this program on Point. Great to have you today. Thank you, David.
You bet.
And Olivier Knox, president of the White House Correspondents Association. Olivier, thank you as well. It's great having you today.
Thanks for hosting me.
And Mona Charon, syndicated columnist in Washington. Thank you. I really appreciated your perspective as well. Thank you for joining
us.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at onpointradio.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.